And welcome to Endeavors, coming to you from wherever you are, wherever you may be, or wherever you might have been. We are coming at you on terrestrial radio from Vancouver, Halifax, Fredericton, St. John, Cape Breton, Toronto, and Lake Cowichan. My name is Dan, and I will guide you through this web of intricate storytelling for the next hour or so. I have two fantastic guests on the show with me today. We have British musician Steph Connor talking about her work, The Flood, which is essentially a retelling of the Epic of Gilgamesh. All the songs are sung in either Sumerian or Babylonian and composed on the lyre. She performed the selections with her group, The Lyre Ensemble. I will talk to Miss Connor about what drove her to create such a unique work of art and her current project of working with homeless people to create opera. And you will also hear from Sean Conroy. He made headlines a few days ago. He is a baseball player for the Sonoma Stompers of the Independent Pacific Association. And he's gay. He is arguably the first out active professional baseball player. Only two have come up previously. And we'll get into that and how, you know, how it's been received and where he thinks it'll go going forward. But first, we're going to start with a song off of Steph Connor's album, The Flood. This is the title track, The Flood.
Come on, keep up, aperçu et ta loue n'a jamais chanim il anikima kali kununu ishashi ishtakima
Well, Steph Connor is probably smarter than your average musician. She got her first class degree in music, the Undergraduate Prize for Academic Achievement, and Poulenc's Double Piano Concerto in D minor under her belt. She then went on to complete a Master of Arts in Jazz, setting performance with John Taylor, Julian Arguelles, and Louise Gibbs. But that's not all. In 2007, she began working towards a PhD in composition and then joined the Northumbrian folk group Rachel Unthank and the Winterset, now the Unthanks, as a pianist and backing singer. Through that work, Connor became immersed in the English folk tradition, performing at venues such as the Barbican, Convent Garden Opera House, Shepherd's Bush Empire, Joe's Pub, and the Chicago School of Folk, as well as festivals including Glastonbury, The Big Chill, Love Box, Belladrome, Electric Picnic, Port Fairy Folk Festival, Celtic Connections, and WOMAD. She appeared with the band on television and radio, including performances at the BBC Folk Awards and the Mercury Music Awards, and even recorded a promotional video at Studio One of Abbey Road. Now she's performed with and recorded by numerous leading soloists and ensembles, including the Kritzker Quartet, Esoterics, Juice, the New New Ensemble, John Porter, the Philharmonia Orchestra, the 24, and Ruth Kagan. Her debut album is called The Flood, which she composed with her group, the Lyre Ensemble. So just what exactly is the Lyre Ensemble? It is a collaboration between Connor, Andy Lowings, who is an instrument builder, harpist, and creator of the Gold Lyre of UR project, and sound engineer, producer, and harpist Mark Harper. Based on Mesopotamian text from as early as the 4th millennium BC, and composed for a voice and the Lyre of Ur, which is a reconstructed 4,500-year-old instrument excavated in the early 20th century. It is the first ever CD of new music sung entirely in Sumerian and Babylonian. The title track, which you just heard, is a sung version of the flood narrative from the Babylonian epic of Gilgamesh. I had the chance to speak with Steph Connor earlier today about this project. Steph Connor, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So this is the album is The Flood with the Lyre Ensemble. This is a very interesting project. When did you first decide that you wanted to tackle this older form of music?
I think possibly at the age of about 5, I realized that I was slightly obsessed with ancient cultures, and I'm never going to understand why, but it's been something that has kind of captivated me my entire life. And I think it's just something about connecting or having a sense of a kind of empathetic connection with people who lived thousands of years ago feels really life-affirming to me. And so as a kind of mature musician, I found myself revisiting that time and time again, not just with Babylonian music, but with Anglo-Saxon kind of poetry and song and kind of ancient Chinese poetry as well. And so because the Babylonian poetic corpus is so rich and exciting, I guess it was only a matter of time before I started getting into that.
There is somewhat of a mystical lyricism that's present throughout some of the songs. How did you identify with that just as a writer and as a song maker?
I think it's very easy to identify with because, well, first of all, the just in terms of structure, the poems are very formulaic because they would have been, I'm sure, learnt orally, and they were written down to preserve them. They weren't written down, you know, to pass them on from one person to another to learn. I think they would have just been in the air, in the culture, in the same way that kind of nursery rhymes and game songs are in our culture now. And they're formulaic, so you can learn them, and they feel earthy, and they're something that everyone kind of shares in. But more importantly than that, the subject matter deals with things that are just universal aspects of the human experience, you know, birth, death, love and loss, eating, sleeping, sex, making yourself look beautiful, just things that are just part of being human that it's nice to be reminded always have been and probably always will be.
Now, one instrument that features prominently is the lyre, which is not something that we hear a lot of in sort of modern music, even though many of the string instruments are related to it in many ways. How was the learning process of that for you?
Playing with the lyre, or singing with the lyre, was a real learning experience for me, and it was something to get used to, because when you're used to playing with modern instruments like the piano and the guitar, you're used to being able to play lots of different chords and modulate, change key, play in the modern tuning system that we're all used to. And when you're working with a lyre that's only got 5 strings, 6 strings, or 11 strings in the case of the silver Babylonian lyre, 7 for the gold lyre, you're quite limited in terms of the number of notes that the accompanying instrument can play. Which makes it very sort of suitable for the kind of music that I imagine probably would have been sung in ancient Babylon, or, you know, would be used in kind of rituals and music that's learned communally, things like that. But when, like me, you're trying to do something kind of cutting edge and modern, you sort of end up having to sing all kinds of notes that clash with what the lyre's playing, because the lyre can only keep playing the same kind of 5 or 6 notes over and over again. So it actually, because of the lyre, because of its limitations, I ended up creating a kind of music that was totally new and different from anything I'd done before, and actually took me into a whole new area that really changed my musicianship for the better.
A lot of artists seem to like that by having limitations or restrictions often imposed by themselves or by others, they tend to create something maybe better than if they didn't have those restrictions. Did you find that to be the case with you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's almost like, I mean, when you're about to start on a creative project, I guess it's probably the same for anything. You probably, you know, it would have had the experiences yourself that are similar. If you're doing a creative project of any kind, you start off the first kind of step towards making something is to find a limitation, you know, so setting a theme is a limitation, or just choosing a text that inspires you, or even choosing the art form that you're going to, choosing the medium you're going to use is a limitation, because otherwise you're confronted with infinity, which is totally overwhelming and you just explode. So yeah, in a way for me, the more limitations, the better, and the more you have to stretch yourself to come up with something that you think is good.
We've talked a lot about, you know, Babylon and Babylonia, and how much research did you have to do in terms of Babylonian culture to make sure that what you were playing and singing and writing was historically and culturally accurate?
We did quite a lot. It sort of relatively speaking, because none of us are academics, we're just musicians. I have an academic background, so research is something that I kind of am very inclined towards doing anyway, because it inspires me and I'm used to it. But you know, the idea was to make art, not to do a scholarly project. But for a piece of art, I think the amount of research was above average. We did a lot of work. We did a lot of thinking. Nonetheless, it's really important to emphasize that this isn't a scholarly reconstruction project. It is new music. And we're not trying to make music as it would have sounded in ancient Babylon. We're trying to, you know, make something new and exciting. However, so many of our ideas came from what we learned about the culture, about the history, about the texts, about their social context, and it was a really important part of the process. And in a way, it's very difficult now to separate the ideas that came from the research from the ideas that were kind of intuitive and imaginative.
It brings up an interesting point, though, because you mentioned sort of the differences between scholarly and artwork, and I'm curious as to whether you think, because you've identified it as art, as to whether that will turn more people on to it if it was just a scholarly paper or a scholarly project, let's say.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It's a tricky one. It's really hard to say, because the exposure that it got, that this project got, only happened by chance. And it happened because I was presenting an academic paper at a conference, and I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll sing one of my Babylonian songs at the same time, because I was talking about ancient music, ancient Mesopotamian music. Of course, everyone was thoroughly bored by the presentation, but they really enjoyed the song, and that was what you got people interested. It's what got me a bit of exposure, and that's what brought people in. So, the fact that it's a piece of art, that it's interesting, that it's creative, is what has drawn people into it, not the academic side of it. Although. A lot of the people that have become interested, I think, have mistaken it for a kind of reconstruction project. So it's quite a nebulous area.
What can art teach us and inspire us that perhaps maybe more traditional methods of academia can't?
Oh, what a great question. I'm so pleased you asked me that. I'm very passionate about that, actually. As a person who, as a researcher in the past, has been involved in practice-led research, I really believe that one of the really wonderful ways of engaging with a subject and really understanding it at a very deep level is to practice it. So if you're an architect, then designing buildings is a great way to learn about, you know, architecture and to research it. Similarly, I think a great scholar of music will often be someone who has understood music through being a practitioner. And so the same can be said for understanding ancient cultures. So, for example, if you, you know, if you want to learn about Babylonian poetry and you want to understand how maybe it functioned in its cultural context as an oral medium, then go out and try to learn it by heart, learn it by rote, and then teach it to some people and learn to sing it together, and then see what happens naturally by practicing, by doing, by bringing the music alive and singing it and speaking the poetry. Then you'll understand it in a way that you couldn't possibly if you're just looking at it on a piece of paper.
So talk about the language aspect of it, because you sing in Sumerian. What was that like for you? How did you go about learning that?
Oh, Sumerian's a difficult one, actually. It's a slightly different kettle of fish from Babylonian, because there's a lot of a lot more is known about how Babylonian or rather Akkadian, which is Babylonian and also Assyrian dialects, how Akkadian would have sounded, because it's part of the Semitic language family. Sumerian is a language isolate, so it's mainly guesswork, really, when you try to pronounce Sumerian texts. So you look at a transcription, or a transliteration rather, of the cuneiform symbols, which were made on clay tablets in Sumer and in Babylon and in Mesopotamia, and academics and researchers, particularly at Oxford University was the resource that we were using. They've transcribed that into kind of the alphabet that we use in the Roman alphabet, and they kind of vaguely know some things about how it's pronounced, but it's so poorly understood. And because it was such a long time ago, 4,500 years ago, it's almost impossible really to know things about intonation and real subtleties of pronunciation. So it is, I have to say, mainly guesswork. And looking a little bit at the structure of the poetry, trying to make an educated guess about the kind of the contours, the ups and downs of it, based on and how many syllables there are in each little line and things like that.
Did you go to any linguists at all, or is there just nobody that studies this language, because it's just so hard to figure out what exactly it was?
There are people who study it, absolutely. It's just that because in Sumerian, at the moment, it's kind of impossible to focus on the kind of detail that linguists look at in, say, living languages. Most of the work is done on structural things, so on rather than on the phonology of it, it's on the kind of the grammar, the structure of it, a lot on themes and imagery and things like that. So I tried to familiarize myself as much as possible with what research there was. And then everything else is speculation. So we're sort of, it was quite nice, really, because it freed us up to just, have some fun, really, and make stuff up.
Obviously, you sing in that language, but I don't imagine it's a language that you would continue to practice sort of after this art project has been completed.
No. Well, I'm still going with Babylonian, because as I said, there's a bit more mileage in that. You can get to a higher level, and it's got things in common with Arabic and Hebrew, so there are a lot of reasons to do that. Sumerian is a fairly esoteric hobby. And of course, if I had infinite time in my life, then I'd love to learn as much as possible. But I guess whether I do any more kind of delving into it will depend on whether I decide to do another album of ancient Mesopotamian poetry.
When you were making this album, what did your research sort of teach you about the history of the Middle East, sort of the history of that whole story, however you want to frame it?
One of the things, that's a great question. One of the things that I found most interesting when I was learning about the general kind of historical context of the ancient Mesopotamian texts that we looked at was, first of all, really, for someone that's not a specialist in ancient history, the time depth is just mind-blowing. It's sort of like if you go diving and you're diving in fairly shallow waters and suddenly you come to one of those ledges that just drops away to the deep sea and you think, oh my God, that this is such a big space. I've never really imagined something that vast. And you sort of used to learning, you know, about kind of modern history, you know, 50 years ago this happened, 100 years ago this happened. And then you're thinking about, you know, blocks of 1,000 years and the number of kings that whiz by in your learning is just mind blowing. The thing that really stuck with me, I think most of all, was the richness of the culture, the sophistication of it, and how this incredible, exciting culture with so many aspects that resonate today is actually not talked about that much in modern Western education. I think it's neglected for the Greeks, the Romans, and the Egyptians, but also how much of that culture was exported to ancient Greece and Rome and Persia and even India long before a lot of the kind of major advances in those other sort of cradles of civilization. So things like mathematics and things like that were all exported to Greece, and so lots of things that we associate with ancient Greece and ancient Rome, you can find, and even some important religious texts and things like that, you can find in ancient Mesopotamian literature, and that's absolutely fascinating.
So I know actually right now, if I'm correct, you're working on an opera. Is that true? Did I read that correctly?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I'm working on an opera which is going to be performed by people who have experienced homelessness in London.
And it's called Streetwise Opera. How did you get involved with this project?
It was a competitive application, actually. They put out a call to get a composer in residence for Streetwise Opera, and I'd sort of been following their work and was totally bursting with admiration for what they did. I thought it was about the coolest thing I'd ever heard of, so I just applied and was very lucky. So I've been working with the organisation for 2 years now, getting to know them and getting to know all of their performers, who are all people who've, as I said, experienced homelessness in London. And it's a really interesting, colourful group of people and very inspiring to work with.
Artists are often some of the most charitable people around. And how can art perhaps help people in ways maybe more traditional economic philanthropic efforts can't?
I think art and compassion are so closely related, because in creative expression, you know, a lot of the time what you're doing is exposing something that you feel. You're being honest, you're being really open. And in sort of day-to-day polite society, people don't expose the depths of their feelings to each other, because, you know, in most social situations or professional situations, that's kind of a bit awkward. But laying your heart out on the line in a piece of art, it's going to kind of normalize that kind of depth of expression and communication and feeling, which encourages other people who experience it with you to do the same thing. And that kind of openness and sharing is deeply healing. So I think the compassion and the honesty that we experience in art are really valuable. But not only that, but just the sense of self-esteem that you build from creating something and from the whole process of, you know, collaborating if you're working with other people, or just seeing something from start to finish if you're working on your own, and creating some new wonderful dynamic thing which is part of who you are is really life-affirming.
Well, the album is The Flood. I love it. It's a very extravagant yet quite wonderful piece of work. Steph Connor, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Alrighty, cheers.
Okay. Okay, cool.
And that, again, was Steph Connor. Debut album is The Flood, Steph Connor and the Lyre Ensemble, and you can visit her website at Steph Connor, StephConnerr.com. We're going to hear another track now off of The Flood. This is the song Babale Tenanche. As of this year, 2015, there are 178 pro athletes that were out of the closet. Active athletes. Hockey. The National Hockey League has people like Nancy Drolet of the Canadian women's team, or the late Brendan Burke, who was the inspiration for You Can Play. In the NFL, there is, of course, Michael Sam. And former NFLers Roy Simmons, Esser Otuolo, Wade Davis, and Kwame Harris. Even the NBA has one in Jason Collins. And you've got others in tennis, like Martina Navratilova or Amélie Mauresmo in swimming, like Mark Tewksbury. But what about baseball? One of the oldest sports in America, having been around since the 1870s, only two baseball players have ever come out. The late Glenn Burke, who played for the Dodgers and the Oakland A's, who was said to have been out to the players and management during his playing career, and also allegedly invented the high five. And Billy Beane, who is now the ambassador of inclusion for Major League Baseball, not to be confused with Billy Beane with an E, the current general manager of the Oakland A's. But we can now add a third name to that list. Sean Conroy. Who is Sean Conroy? Well, Sean Conroy is a 23-year-old pitcher for the Sonoma Stompers of the Independent Pacific Associates of Baseball Professionals League. He had been out since he was 16 to his friends and family. And recently, the management at the Stompers organization approached him and asked if he wanted to pitch during the already announced LGBT Pride Night at the Stompers Field. And Sean did well, boasting 11 strikeouts. It's been a bit of a whirlwind for Sean recently with all this media coverage, and I had the chance to speak with him earlier today about how he's handling this and where he thinks the future of LGBT people in sports will go. Sean Conroy, thanks so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, I got to say congratulations on your big announcement. When did you decide that this was information you were going to make public?
It was back in high school about 7 years ago. I just wanted to be myself, wanted to, you know, let my teammates know the real me, and then it's just kind of carried over since then through college and now to indie ball.
I mean, I think in many ways our generation, you know, it's a little more fortunate because our generation is, in many ways, tends to be more accepting of a person's sexuality. Did you find that when you first came out?
Definitely. You know, talking to older people who may have influenced me, you know, just like telling me stories and just like seeing how it used to be, I definitely feel like this generation is way more accepting.
You appeared on, I guess, was it the Stompers were having some sort of LGBT Pride Night, and that's when this story first broke. Do I have that information correct?
Right. Yeah. There was already a Pride Night in the schedule before I had come out to the front office, but after I came out to them, they asked me if I wanted to start that game, so I said I would.
Coming out to your peers and your teammates is one thing, but it's another thing to come out to the front office and your bosses. What was the reaction that you got from them?
They've all been really supportive. I mean, we have a close relationship with, like, most of the players do with the front office. The way the teams run, it's pretty laid back, you know. They want to get your opinions on things. So the fact that I was already pretty close to them when I came out, they've just been really supportive since then. And, you know, we still have friendly conversations.
And you had quite a good performance that night. You got a 11 strikeouts. Talk a little bit about what was going through your head on that start. Was it just like any other start for you, or was the fact that there was this other event on the night any factor for you?
It was definitely stressful before the game started, you know, leading up to it, trying to get ready and keep my mind clear. But once I got out on the mound, you know, it's a completely different animal. You know, trying to do what I do day in and day out on the mound, you have to really work on clearing your head. I actually didn't realize how much of an aftermath there was after the game. I mean, I wasn't expecting it, and it was certainly overwhelming.
Now you do play in California and in the Pacific Coast, which is in many ways probably a lot more LGBT friendly than maybe some other states and some other cities in the US. Have you been able to judge the reaction on you know, maybe cities where you don't have such a close knit community of friends?
I haven't really heard anything from anywhere else, but, you know, if I ever travel around, then I'm sure I'll see. But, you know, since just being here, everyone's been really supportive, you know, whenever I go out.
There's been two ball players, of course, that have come up previously to you, Glenn Burke and Billy Bean, who's now the MLB Ambassador of Inclusion. Have you heard from Mr. Bean at all since your announcement?
Well, I read an article where I think he called me some sort of like leader, which was just incredible that he was even talking about me. I had a surreal moment, but I mean, I haven't spoken with him directly, but I'm really happy that he knows I exist. I mean, that was just incredible for me.
Maybe it was John Amici I heard say several years ago that sports is sort of one of the last areas that people don't talk openly about their sexuality, kind of like the military before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. Do you think that's true? And why do you think so many people have been perhaps hesitant to expose this side of themselves in a sporting environment?
You know, I'm not sure why the MLB is different than any other sport. If I had to guess, I would say it's just coincidence that, you know, it's one of the last places just because no one wanted to come out after they already made it to the MLB or whatever the reason was. But I don't know. I would say it's just coincidence.
Do you think, I mean, perhaps maybe there's a, you know, there's a masculinity part of it and that perhaps people feel that coming out will make them less masculine. What do you have any thought as to whether that argument is valid?
I mean, I think everyone is different regardless of sexual orientation. So, I mean, that definitely could be a stereotype and a reason why someone wouldn't want to, but I don't think it holds valid.
Yeah. Now you play in an independent league right now, but have any major league teams or perhaps any, you know, double A, triple A teams come a calling your way recently?
You know, I haven't gotten any phone calls yet, but I still have my fingers crossed, and I'm going to keep working hard every day.
How would you rate the sort of the skill level and the competitive nature to your league compared to the major leagues or even a double A, triple A team?
It's hard for me to really describe. I mean, it's, you know, obviously the highest level baseball I've ever played, but I don't know how it would be to play in the major leagues. I mean, it's probably slightly below, you know, minor leagues and all that, but at this level, it's so close the whole way, you know, such subtle differences that separate everyone.
Yeah. In a way, were you surprised that your story even became headline news, considering the era in which we live in? That's one of acceptance. Were you surprised that your story became as big as it did?
I was definitely surprised it became as big as it did, as fast as it did, especially since, you know, it's not really new for me. I mean, I've been an openly gay baseball player, like I said, for 7 years. So just the fact that now it's really public information is what's different for me.
How has that changed your life in any way now that you sort of become this known figure, at least for a while?
Right now, it's just people are joking with me about it. I haven't really noticed anything too life-changing other than, you know, all the support on social media and, you know, all the phone calls from family and friends. But it's still just overwhelming at this point, you know, about just a couple of days out.
I was talking with one of my online baseball groups after I posted this story, and we were all totally supportive and with you, but I think there was an issue raised about whether it would become a distraction in the clubhouse because there would be so much more attention, justly or unjustly, focused on you because of this. What do you have to say about that?
I would say that, you know, in the clubhouse, we all just joke around, we have a good time. I don't think that there's really any, or at least that much more attention based on me. You know, we're still a team, and in the clubhouse, we all carry the same weight. I'm still a rookie on this team, you know, I still gotta carry buckets, carry equipment, so it hasn't changed too much.
You know, I mentioned this before that I think our generation is fortunate in that there's a lot more support for openly gay people, whether they're athletes or not. But what would you say to someone who either opposed you or whose opinion of you as a person or as a ball player has changed for the negative now that you've come out with this?
I try to just ignore it for the most part, but if it was ever, you know, to my face or I had to defend myself, I would say that first and foremost, I'm a baseball player and my sexuality doesn't change anything. Now I have a drive to win on the field, a drive to be the best, and the fact that I'm gay doesn't change that.
People might like to bring up Jackie Robinson, the first black ball player, because he perhaps faced a lot of the abuse and hate when he was coming out. Do you see any parallels at all between your story and his?
I don't really feel comfortable making that comparison myself because he experienced so many like personal attacks, or at least that's what I've been led to believe. And me personally, I haven't gone through really any of that, so I can almost see where people are coming from, but I wouldn't make that comparison.
Do you think we'll see a day soon when a current major league ball player will come out? I mean, given the number of players that are in the league at any one time, everyone says that odds are there's at least a handful of gay players. Would you encourage that person to come out, or would you just say, you know, maybe wait?
I would encourage that person to just be themselves, and I don't know. It's hard for me to really give advice without knowing their situation, but I would say just be yourself and come out whenever you're comfortable to do so, or just stay how you are. Either way, you know, just whatever makes you happy.
What do you want, you know, a young kid playing Little League Baseball who is perhaps struggling with the decision to come out? What would you want to say to him or her?
I would say that every situation is different. You know, you have to know that people around you will support you, you know, surround yourself with loved ones. And then when you feel comfortable to come out, because, you know, it does get better. And, you know, since I've came out, I've just been all around a happier person. You know, I didn't have to lie to the people around me, and it's just been great.
So how do you think the rest of your season? How's your team looking? Do you think so far and through the next few months? Are you encouraged with the progress that you guys are making?
Yeah, I mean, the team is pretty successful right now. I mean, we started the season 18-4, so I'm excited to, you know, keep on playing well, keep on playing as a team. And we'll have success.
Who do you like in the majors this season? Who do you think is going to do well?
Well, I mean, since I'm in California, the Giants are looking pretty good. But I mean, I'm New York born and raised, so I always root for the Yankees too.
Oh yeah, I've been a Toronto fan most of my life, so I sense a little bit of a rivalry here. No, kidding. but yeah, the East Division I think is quite remarkable. You have four teams within a game of each other. When you have a division that's that close and that competitive, what does that do to the overall drive of a team, would you say?
I don't know. I mean, it's definitely important to just go out and try and win every game. So, especially with the MLB season being so long, you just have to maintain focus, and when the division's close like that, just every game you have to be locked in because it becomes that much more important.
Well, Sean Connor, I thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck with the rest of the Stomper season.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's our show for today. My thanks to Sonoma Stompers pitcher Sean Conroy, as well as Steph Connor. We're going to take you out with a final track on Steph's album with the Lyre Ensemble, The Flood. This is Lullaby. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye. Thank you.
Ooh.